All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you very much. Be seated, please. Good morning. Welcome again to the Idaho Supreme Court, appearing in Coupon County this morning for the second hearing of September 17, 2025, a matter entitled Acorn Investments LLC versus Elsasser. The appellant, Acorn Investments, is represented by Mark A. Ellingson, and the respondent, Ford Elsasser and Elsasser Anderson Chartered, is represented by Bryn Muller. Counsel, do either of you have preliminary matters for the court?
No, Your Honor.
Very well, Mr. Ellingson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it would be helpful to spend some time talking about the history of this case, to understand the context of what happened globally, because this is case upon a case upon a case, and you're seeing just a narrow portion of it, and so I think it's helpful to kind of give a background so you can understand this. This unfortunate case started out as a landlord-tenant dispute between Acorn and Laughing Dog. Acorn was the landlord, Laughing Dog was the tenant, and what happened was Laughing Dog didn't pay rent, and so we went through an eviction process. And during the eviction process, Laughing Dog literally destroyed the building. I mean, the property damage was incredible, to the tune of about $450,000. It was that bad. And so we ended up getting a judgment against Laughing Dog, or Acorn got a judgment against Laughing Dog by default, ultimately.
For how much?
I think it was around $470,000, something like that. I can't recall exactly, but it was over $400,000, under $500,000. I think it was close to $480,000, something like that. And so after the default judgment was entered, this is a collection case. This is what I do. I'm a collection lawyer. So we start doing debtor's exams of Laughing Dog, bringing him in. Hey, we need to find out your assets. We need to collect upon this judgment. At that point, Mr. Elsasser appeared in the case and started defending Laughing Dog's interest in that proceeding, that collection proceeding. And what happened was, obviously, Laughing Dog became very concerned about losing its assets, to this collection activity that was going on by Acorn. And at this point, Mr. Elsasser, which we find out later, all the stuff we find out after we've done the fraudulent conveyance suit, and we didn't know any of this stuff was going on until we start the fraudulent conveyance suit later and find out, he was the mastermind of all this. He's the one who engineered everything that went on here to essentially deprive my client the ability to collect upon his judgment. And so at that time, he was not only representing Laughing Dog, but he was also representing AHR and Fetchingly Good, which are all entities all owned by Lewis Patrick, who is the controlling person of all three entities. And what's most disturbing about this, I'm a creditor's rights lawyer, and I've dealt with Mr. Elsasser a long time in this field, is that the proper course of action would have been for Laughing Dog, if it wanted to keep its equity, keep its assets, file a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. File a Chapter 11, give Acorn the opportunity to file a claim, and in a Chapter 11, the debtor has to pay creditors like Acorn the equity that's there in the business, the assets. That's the proper course of action. The one person who knows that, that's Mr. Elsasser. He's been seminal Chapter 11 debtor's lawyer for a long time. That did not happen, and that is the problem. Instead, he concocted this sort of scheme where he trumped up debt owing to Laughing Dog, Laughing Dog to AHR, and Fetchingly Good. And then, basically what happened was he created a debt that didn't exist and then had the assets of Laughing Dog be transferred to AHR and Fetchingly Good as a sort of exchange, like, here are the assets, and we'll just excuse the debt. Again, no Chapter 11 process for a creditor to come in and object to this and deal with this. Not even a foreclosure sale where people might come in and bid at it. And actually bid because the value, and this is an entity that has a name, has very valuable business assets, and basically just prevented our client from being able to recover that by that transfer. And so we find out this after the fact that, okay, Laughing Dog didn't, in fact, owe the sort of money it claims it did to AHR in Fetchingly Good when a transfer of probably $1 million worth of assets went through. So we filed a fraudulent conveyance suit against AHR and Fetchingly Good because we think they're the ones. They did this. Well, Mr. Alsasser should never even represented them at this point. There's a conflict. What does he do? He continues to represent them, which, despite all the ethical rules that say you shouldn't be doing this because you're the mastermind of this deal, you're the one who created the problem, he continues to represent them for, I think it was over a year. And we're engaging in discovery, and then it comes to pass that he finally figures out he can't, the conflict is too good. He's having problems with his client, and he has to withdraw. And so Attorney Buck and Attorney Conrad appear in the fraudulent conveyance suit. And we're all sitting here going, sharing, rarely do you get in a scenario where you're sharing information with somebody in a fraudulent conveyance suit between the plaintiff and the defendant. We're like, it's very clear what happened here. This was a plan that was concocted by Mr. Alsasser that the client relied upon. He relied upon it thinking this was legitimate. Well, it wasn't, because the debt did not support the value of the assets that were conveyed through, which is a per se fraudulent conveyance. And so we're all looking at it. Who's at fault here? Who's at fault? Well, it was Mr. Alsasser who was at fault here. And they acknowledged that it was a fraudulent conveyance, and they stipulated to a judgment of $900,000+. That's a substantial judgment. They acknowledged that this was in fact a fraudulent conveyance. And we obtained a judgment. It was recorded. It becomes a lien. It has become a lien against AHR's building in Sandpoint. But the part of it was the responsible party to this should be the one to actually pay the price. And Mr. Alsasser did a number of things that not permitted by the ethical rules, not permitted by the Idaho Voidable Transfers Act, and he subjected his client to that consequence. And so the consequence was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. The right thing to do is we'll assign this malpractice. It's a malpractice claim. It's a glaring malpractice claim. The right thing to do is to assign it to Acorn, who was the victim of this, who was the entire subject of why this transaction went through. And so that is what occurred. They and ultimately assigned that malpractice claim to Acorn, and that's why we're here today, is to decide, is this a valid assignment or is this not? And I think when you go back, the decision of this court, I think is going to be obviously heavily influenced by the decision that the Supreme Court made previously in the St. Luke's case. I mean, Justice Jones went out of his way to write a very, I thought it was an impressive opinion in the sense that he spent a lot of time talking about the public policy of why we should allow an assignment like this. You know, at that time, is St. Luke's an insider or a stranger to the transaction? We don't want to have assignments to some third party who has no connection to the underlying transaction. That makes a lot of sense. Justice Jones, when he evaluated, was like, well, no, St. Luke's was right, was part of the deal. They were intimately part of this deal that was the malpractice. So it makes sense that St. Luke's be able to maintain that action. That's the same thing here. I mean, this is as close as you get. This whole malpractice issue was a target against my client. I mean, that's, they're not a stranger to the guy. They're the whole reason the transactions went through. And similarly, you look at it, it's like, who was harmed by this? Who was harmed by the conduct of Mr. Elsasser? Well, ultimately, it was Acorn. Acorn never got to recover. And that's why they should be in a position of going after Mr. Elsasser on this malpractice claim. And so if you look at that, you know, what Justice Jones was talking about, clearly Acorn is not a stranger to this transaction. It fits within that realm that they should be able to have this assignment. And then you go...
Now, let's back up a minute. The stranger to the transaction, as I review St. Luke's versus Luciani, is where they're involved intimately, such as a bank lending funds, and the lenders, the attorneys for the debtor commit malpractice and mess up to the attorney, or even the lender's attorneys do. They can assign that when they also take assets of the businesses. Did Acorn take any assets?
Well, just the if you go back to the judgment.
No, I'm talking whatever they had in their building. Did they take any assets?
No, there were no physical assets.
Okay, so all they got was the assignment and the judgment. That's not going to be collected on until this goes away. Or apparently, if you win in the case against Elsasser, then that judgment is deemed satisfied.
It may get paid right through that proceeding. Yes,
but maybe I didn't read it carefully enough. But I understood the stipulation to be that if there's a resolution here, whether it's paid in full, paid in part, not, there's never going to be a collection against
likely not
Laughing Dog.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I believe that's true.
So it seems to me there's a bit of a distinction here between being a third party to the transaction or not. Acorn is certainly not a part of the advice given by Elsasser, admittedly, potentially fraudulent, whatever it was. And you have an independent action pending, I think, up in Sandpoint over that right now, right?
Right.
So you have a cause of action for those claims that obviously are your independent claims. They're not a malpractice. You weren't his client. So I guess as I read some of the cases that go against your position, they seem to indicate that there's a policy behind why we don't allow, in general, malpractice claims to be assigned because of the kind of things we kind of are seeing here. We're going to get a big, huge judgment, maybe double what was originally owed by these people for rent and damage to the building. And we'll get that assigned off and go after this attorney and his malpractice carrier. And because it's just a straight-up assignment, and then we're going to prove the case within the case, and we have this huge judgment against these people for his negligence. How's that not somewhat collusive in character as well and go against the notion that he shouldn't be assignable in general?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the stipulation of facts, what was stated in the record, it's pretty clear what happened. That hasn't been disputed. So we're assuming there's collusion when, in fact, there's undisputed facts from our client. This is what happened. Mr. Elsasser has never contested that. He's never to date disputed that. And so you get in a situation like this where, again, it was more than just an assignment of the claim. There was a judgment that went with it as well. AHR is a piece of real property. It's basically a single asset LLC with a building. And so it gave up $900,000, transferred $900,000 in equity that they may have to Acorn along with the assignment. So there was, and granted, these two cases don't factually pair up exactly. I mean, I will acknowledge that. But I think the concept was there's more to it that went with this assignment than just the claim. And then, you know, I was thinking about it. You know, you think about the concept, and this is a strange concept, but third-party beneficiaries under a contract. Let's talk about contract law. Party A and Party B enter into a contract, right? But there's a third-party beneficiary that contract is intended to benefit. They're not a part. This third party is not a party to this contract, but they're a beneficiary of it because they're the subject of the contract.
This third-party beneficiary doctrine is much more narrow than that, and I think the court has narrowly construed it in terms of it's got to be an intended beneficiary. You better have something in that contract that is stating specifically that that the contract is intended to benefit them, not just, you know, you've got your client was a creditor. You know, and while they may have a pecuniary interest in whatever contracts go on between these related companies, they're not the intended beneficiary of them.
Well, and if I'm trying to just use this as a comparison, and I know they don't match up exactly, but the concept is Party A and Party L, Sasser and AHR enter into a deal. They're going to do legal services, ultimately to harm Acorn. Okay, that's the intent of this contract. This is the intent of this fraudulent conveyance scheme.
But I imagine that L. Sasser would say, no, it was to benefit my clients.
Right.
I mean, there is a difference there. You know, it seems like there's a pretty broad brush of painting someone as the villain, and I understand the concerns. Believe me, I understand the concerns. But there's a different side to that. So I don't know that it's fair to say the intent is to damage Acorn when someone else might say the intent is to protect my client.
But if you're Ford L. Sasser and you know transferring more of value of assets than the debt, you know you're engaging, you of anybody, not the client, should know you're engaging in a fraudulent conveyance scheme. And you know the effect, what it's going to happen to Acorn. I mean, that was the whole point of it. So I understand he was doing services for AHR and Laughing Dog, but the whole point of it, and you see his email as part of the stipulation, he's talking about, here's what we're going to do, because people like Acorn essentially won't have the money to fight this thing. And he was clearly the target. And I think we're talking about the merits of the case. I mean, he can come in as, you know, in cases that move forward and argue that. That's going to be what's litigated, but at least give Acorn the ability to have that fight. You know, to knock it off now would be unfair. And I think you go back to that case, St. Luke's, and you talk about what Justice Jones spent a lot of time talking about.
Well, and my struggle with the St. Luke's case for you is I'm concerned you're analyzing Justice Jones' comments, policy concerns in a vacuum. Because St. Luke starts from the common law premise that tort causes of action are generally not assignable. Why? Because they're personal to the person who holds the tort right, and the vindication is for the damage to the person. So we step back and you read Luciano, and Luciano is saying, all right, St. Luke's, we're going to apply an exception here because you stepped into the shoes of the party that was injured. And how did you step into the shoes of the party that was injured? You took on all of their liabilities, you took on all of their responsibilities, and you settled the injuries that they suffered. You settled the employee discrimination case, you settled the other claims that you had to suffer because of the attorney malpractice. And so you stepped into the shoes of the injured person. You suffered the injuries too. We're going to let you resolve them and transfer this tort cause of action. And Acorn, it strikes me, is just a creditor. And I'm not saying they weren't damaged, but from the can you apply this exception to the general rule, tort causes of action are not assignable because they're personal to the individual who was injured. I'm not seeing Acorn was injured by the conduct, but Acorn didn't step into the shoes of Laughing Dog and suffer the injury that Laughing Dog did. They suffered downstream injuries. And so that's where I'm struggling with how to apply, how can Luciano apply to Acorn?
And the thing is, I think you need to have clarity on who was assigning the malpractice claim. It wasn't Laughing Dog.
And I'm using
Laughing
Dog.
It was HR, and it was Fetchingly Good, who were the ones who did suffer because they got caught up in a fraudulent conveyance suit. They were the ones who are ultimately liable for it.
But those two entities still exist.
They do exist.
Not like St. Luke's, where they sold out and went away, and they didn't have anything.
And, you know, I don't know what they're operating. I mean, at this point, I don't know. I mean, it's been so many years, I don't know what their situation is. So I guess I hold back from making comment on that.
But the point is, Acorn didn't acquire those companies.
No,
and thereby step into the shoes of of AHR, Fetchingly Good, or even Laughing Dog for that matter. It simply was assigned the cause of action, causes of action.
Right, and I think this is a unique case because it is, I mean, where are you going to get these types of facts, you know, that say where a lawyer engages with a client to target somebody? I mean, you know, they targeted Acorn. That was the whole point. They were the victim. So they did suffer the harm. I mean, they did.
And I'm not discounting that they did, but they didn't. And I understand Laughing Dog, you know, I'm using it as an umbrella term rather than having to say everybody's names every time.
Right.
But my point is they didn't step into the shoes of AHR and Fetchingly Good, which is where I think the court goes in Luciano. It's a personal cause of action. You can take advantage of it, St. Luke's, because you stepped into the shoes and took on all the liabilities of the person who did hold the cause of action. And that's not what happened here. So that is my struggle with saying we should apply Luciano here. I'm not disputing that Acorn, if all the facts were proven, that Acorn suffered harm. Without a doubt, Acorn did. But I'm not seeing where Acorn is equivalent to St. Luke's in the Luciano case.
And I get it. Factually, they are different. They are different.
But the policy, the policy justifications underlying the exception applied in Luciano, I'm not seeing how they apply to Acorn when Acorn didn't step into the shoes of HR.
And I think it goes back to that concept. I mean, the concept is stranger to the transaction. Okay, is this somebody just out of the blue who had nothing to do with what was going on, which is the underlying transaction?
No, but I think the concept is whether they stepped into the shoes, whether they're a successor in interest to any of these entities. They clearly aren't.
Right. Well,
strange or true?
Other than,
but a successor?
Other than the claim and then getting the judgment with the equity.
But they're not. I'm sorry.
That makes your client an assignee, not a successor in interest. Isn't that right? I mean, if we're using terms precisely.
They're a judgment creditor against AHR. They're more than just an assignee. I mean, they have multiple, I guess, roles. They are a judgment creditor against AHR and Fetchingly Good. So they're more than just an assignee. They actually have a judgment against them individually.
But with respect to the malpractice claims, they're an assignee.
They are an assignee, right. There's no dispute about that. And that's what we have to decide. Are we going to allow this or, you know, and why, if there has to be movement on in terms of expansion of the St. Luke's doctrine, is that this is, again, a very unique situation. I don't know in any other context where you would have a lawyer and his client creating this fraudulent to actually harm somebody else.
So, counsel, let's look at for just a second the public policy argument a little differently than perhaps it was looked at in St. Luke's versus Luciani.
Yeah.
In that case, perhaps didn't involve the type of fraud that we have here.
Right.
What does the record show us about the wherewithal of Laughing Dog, AHR, and Fetchingly Good to have pursued the malpractice action?
Well,
is this an action in which justice wouldn't have had a chance to prevail if it hadn't been assigned to you? Or could they have gone ahead and carried on the case and Elsasser could have gotten whatever they deserve at that point?
Yeah, and I the record, it's not included in the record, but I can tell you that they are not going to, they don't have the wherewithal to do it. And maybe if that's a situation where you want supplementation, you're remanded for that sort of, that answer. I mean, this is a summary judgment that came out very quickly without any sort of discovery and things like that in the malpractice suit.
And it may not be a proper role of the courts, but in looking at the public policy issue here,
right?
Was this the only way that a just result could be achieved?
They would not have pursued it, I can tell you that. That has been represented to me by Mr. Conrad, who's counsel for both AHR Fetchingly Good.
So, is it your contention that the Luciani case doesn't look at a case involving the type of fraud that we have here, and perhaps if it did, it might have reached a different conclusion about cases of this category?
I think so. Because if you look at it, you know, it talks about the free pass and things like that. We have to be as a court, you know, cognizant that we're not going to allow lawyers like this to get away with that. And where, again, the victim here is Acorn, you know, and if you were not to allow the assignment, then Mr. Elsasser walks away and it goes life right in the face of what Justice Jones talked about, getting lucky breaks, the lawyers, and decisions by this court that will reinforce the perception held by many in our society that courts will go out of their way in order to protect members of the bar. Now, I don't like bringing this action against Mr. Elsasser. I practiced with him, you know, for many, many years. It's you know, it is a very sad day, but we had to pursue this way. And for it to be shut down now without an opportunity to pursue it would fly in the face of what Justice Jones was talking about in the policy decision. Do you have any other questions?
Appears not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get into some of the more complex issues in this case, I think it's worth noting where the factual basis comes from, or the alleged factual basis. And that is from the stipulated settlement agreement and stipulated judgment. There are facts that are agreed to between Acorn and the LBD parties, which is how I'll refer to those parties collectively, that they decide what the facts are. They decide what the liability is, all without any adversarial process, all without any opportunity for Mr. Elsasser or his firm to be involved in that process and raise objection. I want to be very clear with this court at the outset that that document was created in a case where Mr. Elsasser and his firm were not parties, is not binding upon him. Those are not binding factual conclusions. They're not binding conclusions of law. What has been brought was malpractice action by the LBD parties, and Mr. Elsasser and his firm filed an answer denying those claims. The only thing in the record that is in a case in which the Elsasser parties were party to is the denial of the allegations of malpractice. Those have been denied. That is the status of this case. I think it's worth noting that part of the problem that we have here is this oversimplification that arises in a situation like this. We have these two parties who were adversaries who, for a year and a half or more after Mr. Elsasser was no longer involved in that case, all of a sudden decide they're going to play nice and they're going to decide what they think are all these terrible things Mr. Elsasser did. This goes back to one of the public policy issues. We have an opportunity for parties to do that, to kind of home cook the facts, the settlement amount, and their reasons for liability being in place. That's the type of conclusion that the court wants to avoid in the assignment of a malpractice claim. And that's precisely what occurred here. So, again, I would reiterate to this court that those are not facts admitted to in this matter.
But isn't that true when any chosen action is assigned, that there's going to be a party on the other side that's likely going to file an answer denying everything? I mean, do we look at that and say, well, this is a claim that we can't guarantee they're going to win? I mean, I understand that the arguments that Mr. Ellingson made today is what they think they're going to prove on their best day in court. I think we all recognize they may not be able to prove all that. But does that matter when we're looking at the transferability of a chosen action?
So I think it matters to the extent as to how it's being represented to this court. And what I want this court to be clear about is those aren't facts my clients had an opportunity to participate in stipulating.
You'd like us to be healthily skeptical.
Yes. And I think under the circumstances this court should be.
Well, didn't they stipulate that Acorn was damaged by Elsasser's conduct?
When we
in that agreement, settlement agreement?
they did stipulate, when we say they, Acorn.
They, Acorn, and the opposing party in the collection action.
They did, and we stipulated to a very large settlement amount, which was far in excess of the judgment rendered in favor of Acorn. And again, that goes back to, I think that has to be given with a healthy amount of skepticism.
Just clarify for me, you said it was far in excess of the judgment entered in favor of Acorn, where?
So Acorn is a judgment creditor. In the case that was described by opposing counsel over a leasehold and damage done to the leasehold.
Was there an earlier judgment then, independent of this 900 plus thousand judgment?
There is, and that was, and that is the
default judgment.
It was default judgment, and for clarity, for this court's sake, my client was not involved in that case, nor did he represent the LPD parties in that case. And that is what gave rise to this fraudulent transfer fraud action. Is Acorn standing as a judgment creditor. That was the basis on which that other suit was brought. And when we look at that and how that flows into all of this, again, this is an unlitigated, undecided issue, and this is what these two parties got together and decided on their own separately. I think it's interesting to note that we don't have a lot of details because of that. We don't know that what was this transfer of assets or transfer of debt between these entities. Was it for secured collateral? It may well be that Acorn wouldn't have collected anything anyway because these entities were already secured to the key. And which was frankly the case here. Again, what we're dealing with here is not.
Mr. Mollerup, say that point again.
So anytime we have. What has to happen in a fraudulent transfer claims action, right? Say you moved this stuff to another company, and you knew I was a creditor out here when you moved this stuff, right? But if the stuff that was moved remains subject to an Article 9 interest, the Article 9 creditor comes before the judgment creditor anyway, so it's up in the air whether you're going to get anything or not.
So you can void the transfer, but get in line.
But, and that's what I'm trying to get the court to see. It's a very open issue. Would they ever collect anything anyway? And I think you look at the pleadings that are part of this record, I think that's doubtful. And so really what we're deciding here, and why I mention all this, is I think it's unfair for my client's name to be dragged through the mud and act like these are established facts when they're not, because they're not. And what we are here deciding is whether this falls under Luciani, number one. And if it doesn't, is this court going to recognize a new exception to the general ban on assignment? And it would be my suggestion to this court that, number one, this case does not present a situation that is akin in any way, shape, or form to Luciani, because we don't have a transfer, a commercial transfer, which was defined by the Luciani court as a transfer of both assets and liabilities. We don't have that anywhere in this case. So I think it's pretty easy to get through the Luciani issue. As far as should there be a new type of assignment or an assignment under these specific circumstances allowed, I think the court has to look at what the public policy concerns discussed within Luciani and the cases to which Luciani cites. We talked about this issue of collusion. The cited cases within Luciani specifically talk about the risk of that. We have a party that now switches positions and says, well, okay, I guess I'm liable, but it's my lawyer's fault. Without participation of the lawyer, we have these people come together, stipulate to facts, damages, etc., without participation of the lawyer accused of malpractice. We also have this issue.
But doesn't that count? It seems to me that if the action against Alsacer is pursued, he can raise all of those defenses. I mean, because to your point, he's not bound by anything that the party stipulated to. So, I mean, he can prove up that there are no damages caused by the conduct. I mean, he has the ability to present all of that. And I guess to the appellant's point, let's litigate. That's all we want is a chance to litigate it.
Right. But in the context of assignment of a malpractice claim, we're interested in who's litigating it. And I think that's where we get into this interesting shifting of duties, right? Mr. Alsacer had a duty to his clients, which were not Acorn. And what we do when we allow this sort of collusion and assignment is basically, you know, what you've heard today is Acorn was damaged. Acorn wants redress. Well, Mr. Alsacer never owed Acorn a duty. let's say that the ACORN versus the LTV parties gets litigated, and this isn't a fraudulent transfer, all of a sudden that's just good legal services because we prevented collection from this judgment creditor. And so what we can't do is now allow a judgment creditor to come in and say, hey, I want to take over this case against your lawyer because you're too hard to collect against, and now I want to collect against your lawyer.
But what's unfair about it if the appellant in this case is allowed to step into the shoes of his client, how do they have an unfair advantage at that point? Wouldn't they be bringing the exact same claim, just with a different named plaintiff, with the exact same witnesses, using the exact same evidence? If anything, they would have to answer questions for the jury about why the case has ACORN listed as a plaintiff, and they would have to explain that, and they would have to convince a jury that, oh, that sounds kind of sketchy, but yeah, if you want to assign your lawsuit, fine. But as far as the merits of the case and the evidence that would be submitted to prove the merits of the case, it wouldn't be any different, would it?
It wouldn't be any different, except in a couple of respects. And so what we now deal with is another layer of issues to deal with. Sure, as Justice Brody pointed out, we'd have all these defenses to those things, but we have this situation where there's a stipulated judgment, an inflated stipulated judgment, you know, we have to deal with. But again, it matters who's bringing the claim, even if they're assigned.
Why?
Because, and I'm getting there, and it's because of these concerns that the courts have raised about what does this do to the attorney-client relationship. So if we can freely assign these things, even under these circumstances, or any circumstances for that matter, when a judgment creditor has a hard time collecting against a judgment debtor, it's going to be a lot easier to look to the lawyer and his malpractice carrier for collection. And what the policy tells us is we disfavor that outcome. Because now, in an underinsured case, in a case where someone doesn't have many assets to defend the case, it's now going to be very attractive for a plaintiff's counsel or a third party, a judgment creditor, whoever it is, to drive a wedge in between that relationship, get an assignment, and chase the lawyer instead of the judgment debtor.
How is this any different, and maybe it is, but how is this any different if the settlement reached in this case with the transferees in this case, if they had said, they had reached an agreement with ACORN that they're going to retain their cause of action, but they're going to allow ACORN to hire an attorney to represent them, and they're going to pay for it.
So
how would that be any different a result than where we are now?
Assuming the assignment is allowed.
Let's assume there was no assignment, but the settlement was, you're going to agree to let us hire attorneys to represent you, and you're going to follow their directions.
And so that would be an assignment in everything but name.
Yeah.
And suffer from all the same problems. And
is there anything preventing that?
Sure there is, I think. I think that is an assignment in form. And so if we're going to hire the lawyer, we stand to get all the proceeds, right? That's no different than an assignment. Because, frankly, at that point, the beneficial interest in the lawsuit has been assigned to a third party, has been taken over by a third party. I think it is an assignment in everything but name.
But as a judgment creditor, they could certainly attach the interest in the litigation, right?
It is interesting, and courts have dealt with that issue. And that's discussed, I believe, in the Eden case we cite. They discuss a case where that was an issue for a court. They said, hey, can you attach this? Can you not? Their conclusion was, no, you can't, due to all these same policy concerns. So I think that not being an issue in this case, and I know that's an open question, but in other jurisdictions that have looked at that, the answer is no.
You mentioned under the underinsured context. Play that out a little bit to me, because your point wasn't obvious to me.
So when we have an underinsured case, many times the underinsured doesn't have enough assets. Even if judgment is rendered beyond the low limits policy, they have no assets. They're judgment proof, right? And so what happens there is that, well, now the underinsured isn't so interested in getting its own policy limits, right? They don't care anymore. They're happy just to assign whatever claim they think they've got post-judgment to a plaintiff or to a judgment creditor and let them chase their lawyer. And you would have these cases where whether they're meritorious doesn't really matter. Everyone in this room knows that when lawsuits get brought, a lot of times they get settled. People don't want the headache, that's the amount you want. And that's discussed, I think, in the in the Gursky case, which we cited to this court, and I believe is cited by Lucioni. They're pretty clear about that, and that would sort of have this, eventually have this chilling effect where plaintiffs just want to make a deal with the defendant. And I think, well, gosh, I can't collect this excess, right? So I'm going to stipulate, I'm going to settle with you, and we'll just pursue your lawyer. And that's the risk that arises under those circumstances. And that's kind of what you're hearing here today is that, gosh, we can't collect against these guys. We feel we were wrong. So we want to be able to sue their lawyer, right? And that's the precise scenario that all these policy considerations seek to avoid. And so if we have to, frankly, if this case is assignable, it has all the hallmarks that policy, and I would say in the Eden case that we cited to this court, all the policy considerations that we try to avoid at present here, there's an agreement that is collusive. And overinflated damages, statements of liability, statements of fact, and that's discussed specifically in the Eden case. And it's just even this opportunity for collusion, not even that there had to be. These courts talk about wanting to avoid. And beyond that, when we look at how this case is structured, it's, hey, you're never going to have to pay us, LDP parties. You don't have to pay us, whether we collect anything or not. Right? They're relieved of liability at this point. So we've taken all this risk and just transferred it over to the attorney against who the claim is
made. I may have misheard, and if I did, please forgive me, Mr. Ellingson, though I thought he said that LDB wasn't in a position to pursue it at all. They would never pursue this malpractice case on their own.
That's not in any part of the record that I'm aware of. Perhaps that's Mr. Ellingson's knowledge of speaking with these folks. I'm not aware of any part of the record that says.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, if the facts are as you suggest, which is there was really no equity in these assets to begin with, it would seem that Laughing Dog and the related entities would have no interest in pursuing this. I mean, you're not going to find an attorney to take it on a contingency basis because the risk of getting zeroed is very high. So I guess to the appellant's point, you know, you're not going to hold an attorney's feet to the fire when they've somehow violated their ethical responsibilities to their clients.
And so if I understand the court's question correctly, then we're talking about two different things, right? We're talking about an ethical issue, and we're talking about potential success in the merits, right? So I think it's important to note here.
But they're sort of related. I mean, the point is really that you're not going to, and the thing that I think we hear, this is not the only recent case that we've had on attorney malpractice, which is this court doesn't hold attorneys responsible. You know, and we ought to. We ought to do something.
And there's a mechanism to do that. And so there's a few different mechanisms through which that can occur, right? If there is truly a feeling that Mr. Alsacer or his firm violated the ethical canons, our bar has a proceeding for that. An ethical complaint can be filed and pursued. He would stand to lose his license, be suspended, whatever the discipline was done. That's part of a separate proceeding, right? So we have a methodology for that already.
But that doesn't have the potential of making any of the victims whole, does it? Certainly that satisfies a certain justice from a certain perspective. If somebody did something bad, they get what they deserve, but that doesn't make the victim whole.
Right, and I'm trying to answer the questions one at a time. First was, what about the ethical issue? And so that's my answer to the ethical issue. As far as making a party whole, we have a third amended complaint in the LBD litigation that has now been filed against Mr. Alsacer and his firm, party of record before this court. They've alleged fraud, they've alleged RICO claims, etc. They have, at least according to their pleadings, they think they have an avenue to hold Mr. Alsacer and his firm accountable. That exists. When people commit fraud, they violate the law, they collude and violate RICO, it creates this private cause of action, whether there's a term client relationship or not, right? That's what they're saying. They've gotten this other suit. They're pursuing it. That case is live as we sit here. As we move beyond that, as far as holding the attorney's feet to the fire, that's what the client gets to do. The client gets to hold their feet to the fire. If they want to bring a malpractice claim, they can do that. And I think it's important to note here that this dismissal in this case was made by the court below without prejudice. And she did that specifically so that if the LDB parties wanted to come back in and pursue their claim, they could go ahead and do that. I think that hasn't happened. So we have three different avenues. In certain circumstances, there can be a claim against someone else's lawyer under the types of claims that have been brought by a courtier, which is a direct claim by the client, and there are ethical proceedings in order to protect the integrity of our profession. There's a remedy for all of this, but none of it requires assignment, because assignment is fraught with all these side issues that we have. And I think the question for this court really is, if this case is assignable, what case isn't assignable? We have all these issues that crop up in this case that we're trying to avoid. And I think it's a bit of a euphemism to just call this unique and special case. If this case is assignable, there's not one that isn't. And what Luciani was very clear about is that, hey, we're going to be careful about what kind of exceptions we make to this general rule.
But there are different kinds of attorney malpractice cases. There's attorney malpractice cases because they didn't file something on time, or attorney malpractice cases because they didn't get a witness in a Med-Mal case that they should have got in order to show the standard of care. That's one kind of malpractice case. But if it's a malpractice case alleging that attorney created a fraudulent scheme, does the fraud that's alleged in this case, and I recognize it's only alleged, but does the fraud that's alleged in this case change things from a public policy standpoint?
Not for purposes of assignment, and that's because there are causes of action in our legal system that are specifically related to fraud. So if I'm an attorney, whether someone's client or not, and I hatch this plan to go out and defraud somebody, they can prove that, I'm going to be held accountable to that party, client or not. And so I think we're looking at this in kind of a vacuum because we have remedies for those sort of situations. We talk about this type of alleged malpractice, right? There's remedies available for those remedies. And so the assignment of the claim under that circumstance is not all that relevant. And I think that's borne out here by the fact that they've made a complaint against Mr. Alsace from his firm alleging just those types of things. And so if we're worried about harmed individuals being able to be made whole, again, and again, we have an adversarial system as lawyers, right? So what I'm doing for my client is typically not good for the other side, right? I don't want it to be good for the other side. That's not what I was hired for. And so if we start delving into a case like this, then, you know, fraud aside, right, we have, I don't like what your lawyer did because it hurt me. And so let's get together, let's decide they committed malpractice, and let me sue you. That's what we're trying to avoid here. And I think, again, that's the exact thing that all these policy cases talk about. And so having an assignment in a case like this, it would bother the mind to think of what kind of case could be assigned. I think it's probably also worth noting for this court that we've talked about it a little bit, but it's this sort of shifting of duties, right? There's no duty owed to a court. And that's what a malpractice case is all about, is the duty owed to the client. I would tend to think that we've talked a lot about do they have redress? Do they not have redress? Well, we've covered that. I think they do. And again, this just is really about whether or not we want to have free assignment of malpractice cases. If we don't, it has to be very limited situations where that can't occur. So what's happening here is, I think it's clear that Luciani doesn't apply the exception that has on its face. I think that's clear in this case. This was not an acquisition of assets, a merger, or an acquisition of the entire portion of the business, as is talked about in a lot of cases, the land transfer. And all we're left with is a plea to this court to expand or recognize a new exception under the facts of this case. And given what we've talked about here today, I certainly don't think that's warranted in this case. This is not the case in which the court should make such an extension of law. We would ask for the lower court's opinion to be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
Mr. Ellingson, real quick before you get into what you want to say, I just want to know if I heard you correctly that and it may not even be in the record, but that LDB would not have pursued this were it not for the assignment given to you. They wouldn't have pursued it absolutely.
No, and AHR and Fishing League would not. I mean, that was the, I spoke with Mr. Conrad because I preferred that. I'm like, I would rather you guys go guns blazing against this, but, you know, they couldn't afford the litigation. And so we're sitting here, like, we're the only ones who can do this at this point. And, yeah, we were the ones harmed by it. And, you know, you go back, and I just want to maybe pick some things in the record just so it's clear. I know you asked about whether or not there was a judge, you know, what the judgment amount is. It's in the record at page 203. It was, in 2018, it was $471,246.86. And I heard a lot about this number, this 970, whatever, you know, ultimately that was stipulated to in the fraud case, being collusive. Well, we went through and made sure there was no conclusion or conclusive. That number makes up that balance, the 471, plus accrued interest over many years on the judgment, and also attorney's fees and costs. So that because that litigation was expensive. It went on for, I think, a couple of years, and there was a lot of, to get to the point where we figured out this was a fraudulent conveyance. Again, Mr. Elsasser was involved in this case for like a year and a half. He'd never been involved, so he drug things out, didn't do discovery. I mean, you'll see in the record where he spent months not producing discovery, which you can wonder why, and the reason, because he was afraid for his own well-being in this thing when it came out. And once we finally got all the documents and we found it, like, wow, this is it. And this concept that this is going to somehow open the door for assignments of malpractice for creditors to go against debtor's lawyers every time a debtor lawyer hurts a creditor's client, that's absurd in my view. I've dealt with Mr. Elsasser and debtor's counsel for years. Yeah. Creditors take it in the shorts to debtors. I have never once ever sued another lawyer because of that. Yeah, that is right. They're doing their job. I understand the rules. I play by the rules. Mr. Elsasser needs to do the same thing, and he didn't. He had an opportunity to do the right thing and to play by the rules, which is a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. He didn't do that, and so he decided to violate the law, the fraudulent. He owes that duty to everybody under the Fraudulent Conveyance Act. You can't engage in this conduct. That's a duty not only to his client, but in my view, to creditors, because we have to go after it. If you comply with the law, you play by the rules, I'm not coming after you. But he didn't. And again, we talk about this collusive thing, and I think the court was talking about it, was we can get into discovery in this suit. Is this number real? He has every opportunity to defend his interest. But if you slam the door without letting us that opportunity, again, I think you're going in conflict with what Justice Jones said about the perception of what the court's doing with members of the bar, and I think it would be a grave injustice. And I think you look at duty again. Did he owe a duty to Acorn? I think under the Fraudulent Conveyance Act, yes, he did. I also think under the ethical rules. The ethical rules, you can't. Laughing Dog should never have signed a promissory note that it, and documents for a debt that it didn't.
Would that issue come up in a trial?
Yes, it would.
Would you be the plaintiff? Of course, you'd be the plaintiff, yeah. But you'd be asserting the rights that were assigned to you.
Right.
And a breach of a duty to Acorn wasn't a right that was assigned to you.
No.
Those are personal to the people that are assigning the rights
right.
to you.
But I think that's when, I guess my argument is when we talk about, going back to the stranger to the transaction situation, you know, some debt or some you know, debt buying or claim buying company comes in and say, has nothing to do with the underlying malpractices, goes to a plaintiff who has a malpractice, say, hey, I'll buy your claim. They have no connection to this transaction.
I get that, but if you're suing for breach of a duty to Acorn, you don't need these clients' claims to bring that claim, do you?
Well, but I want to be able to bring all the claims that I can because there's different burdens of proof. I mean, a fraudulent conveyance is high bar. Is a high bar. I know that. But if I have another claim that is easier to prove, I'm certainly going to bring it, and I think it warrants it here. So, I'm done. I lose my voice. Sorry.
Thank you very much, Council Leachy. We appreciate your argument. This matter is now under advisement. We'll render a decision in due course and take a brief recess.
All rise, please.